You filed a flight plan to Mountain Rescue. If we don't report in, they'll come looking for us.
Now, that's how it's supposed to work, except I put in a flight plan for Borum Caverns, and this isn't Borum Caverns, is it, Juno?
We're in the wrong cave.
Where are we?
It hasn't got a name. It's a new system. No one's ever been down here before.
Let me ask you a question. Would you prefer to stay alive without your mommy and daddy, or die with them? That's a tough question, huh?
It was moving, it was alive, it knows we're here, we just have to go.
We can't do that.
You didn't see it. I'm not staying here.
If we try to leave, they'd kill us.
We're being quarantined here! We are being kept here to die!
While you were looking for me, I was looking for you. Well, I got you now.
Was that him in the car?
Yeah, sure it was. Didn't walk very far.
Why is that?
Because I cut off his legs.
And I'm gonna do the same to you.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I am fine, Phil. How are you?
I'm good. And in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Excellent. Welcome to our latest episode. And for folks who are new to the podcast, this is, again, Dark Discussions podcast. Basically, it's a weekly podcast that discusses a genre film. So horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, farm films, midnight movies, art house, and drive-in and cult films and whatnot. Basically, we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. We can be found at darkdiscussions.com, the website, which is the Dark Discussions Network website. It's a website that is updated daily with articles, columns, release notices, reviews, and, of course, podcasts. There's about 20 to 30 different podcasts on the network. You can email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com, or you can just press the contact us link on the website, and it basically opens up a little box where you enter your email, and it is sent to us just like if you had emailed us directly. Also, you can join Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group and join the discussion of the topics there or start your own. You can follow us on Twitter at darkdiscussion1. And you can find us wherever podcasts are found. So Stitcher, iTunes, Google, and whatnot. Spotify, iHeartRadio, etc. Eric, what else can people find on the website?
Oh, in addition to all those fine things you just mentioned, they can also find a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to support your online artists, like podcasters. Producing this show is not free. We, and by we, I mean Phil, has to pay for things like server storage and website hosting and all that kind of good stuff. And, of course, the rest of us have to pay to watch movies. So if you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing this show, that's how you can do so. You can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to pick a topic for us to possibly do a show on. We take all the submissions from our patrons, and once a quarter, we draw one at random to do a show about. So if you'd like to do that, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on any page of darkdiscussions.com.
That's right. And actually, I honestly completely forgot, but tonight we are picking a patron. So
I forgot so much I didn't even know what to start with.
it's the quarter, beginning of Q1 of 2021. And for folks who are curious, this is January 7th, 2021 that we are recording this, a Thursday night for folks such as Pam who listen to the podcast, because we do not necessarily release the episodes in order. Now we have to get a randomizer, or someone can just randomly pick a number.
I've got it ready to go. Just give me the number.
Okay. All right, let's do 431.
Okay. So this is going to be a new film onto our list. We still have Rocky Horror Picture Show that we have to get to. Is there anything else in our list that we need to do?
That's it.
That's it?
Yeah, we did Candyman a couple weeks ago.
Okay, wasn't there another film that like we were going to do, but it wasn't available?
Or that one was Dig Two Graves. Yep. That
okay.
One's already recorded. It's in the queue to be released.
Yep. Awesome. Okay. All right, so can we get a drum roll, something, anything?
I think Eric has a little thing. Eric has a button.
Okay. That's a rim shot, wrong one.
That's all I got.
All right, it is number 49.
Number 49. All right, that is the Stand miniseries from 1996. Is it or 94?
Eric, so stand out.
Eric, hit it again. There you go.
That's right. So that's the one with Molly Ringwald and
yep.
Rob Lowe and who played Stu Redman? What's that guy's name? We got to put the Texas guy. God, it was in Forrest Gump.
Not Michael Keaton.
Sinise?
Yeah, Gary Sinise. Yeah. Gary Sinise.
<That's right.
laughs> Who?
Right. All right, and Sean Fox picked that one, the Stand miniseries. So. All right, very good. Thank you, Sean.
Oh, man, that's a lot of watching. That's what?
That's a lot. Yeah, that's long.
Yeah, it's 4 or 5, I thought. Yeah, but it's good. It's good. It's pretty good.
6 hours and 1 minute, according to IMDb.
Wow, it's not
Jesus.
I'll tell you one thing. The miniseries that was 6 hours and 1 minute was way better than the new miniseries, I'll tell you that. Way better. But that's besides the point. All right, sounds good. So we got the Stand miniseries and Rocky Horror Picture Show in the queue to record. And we probably will be able to get to one in January because we've decided that we're probably going to try to do one a month until we get them done after all these special episodes like Best of Year and Retrospect that we're doing next week. Yeah, for folks who are curious, we are skipping what we were looking forward to because of the COVID, so we're not going to do that episode because...
If anything good came out of the pandemic, it's that it finally proved my point that that episode is useless.
Well, it's useless when there's a pandemic because everything gets pushed back, but when
it's
there's no pandemic, it's not as bad. But either way, that's good, and... I think that's pretty much all we got for now, so we can probably get into our episode tonight. So, Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we are doing a 2020 release directed by Michael Matthews, starring Dylan O'Brien, called Love and Monsters.
Don't move.
Let me see it.
Don't move. Amy.
Let me see it.
Okay. Ready?
Mm-hmm. I love it.
That's super sweet, because it's terrible.
Oh, my God.
Where have you been, Joel?
Amy, I love you. I'm going to come find you.
The day of the monster uprising was the day I lost everyone. Only a small fraction of humanity survived and moved underground. I've been scanning for Amy the entire time. And now I finally found her.
Joel!
Hey!
Joel!
Amy, is that you?
Oh my God!
Hey! How far away is Amy's colony?
85 miles. It's an impossible journey.
Everything. We'll try to kill you.
Don't fight. Just run and hide.
Okay.
You really got me going. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing.
You all alone?
Me too. You don't have to talk about it.
You wanna come with me?
that a samurai sword?
Yeah, it is.
Yes, it is. Listen to your instincts out here, man.
What if I have terrible instincts?
You'll die.
Super encouraging speech.
You made it all this way for a girl, huh? You ever hear the term fool's errand?
No!
Amy!
I miss you so much.
We have lost this war.
We could still take our world back.
You're more of a survivor than I thought.
Oh, that was awesome. Oh, I feel like Tom Cruise.
That's right. Love and Monsters. And as Eric mentioned, Michael Matthews directed it, written by Brian DeField and Matthew Robinson. Dylan O'Brien, Jessica Henwick, Michael Rooker are the stars, basically. A number of other minor roles or character actors, such as Ellen Holman, was in it as well. It was supposed to be a major release at movie theaters, but of course, because of the COVID, it was not, and instead went to VOD. It's getting fairly good reviews, 92% on Rotten Tomatoes with 72 reviews, so it's considered a winner, I guess, and we're going to discuss it tonight. So I guess we can get into our thoughts and how we heard about the film. So let's start with you, Abe.
So I caught with this film when, you know, it was, you know, announced to be coming out. But of course, you know, with the pandemic and all that, it being pushed back, it went onto the VOD, but it wasn't available to rent. Which is why we are doing this now. The only option was to actually buy it. But, you know, we always, you know, it's always kind of good to know who you, if, you know, sometimes that's never a good thing. Especially if you're taking a gamble on a movie, even if it's a major release. And so I watched it today, just keep it fresh after, because usually I work during the day. And I absolutely adore this film. You know, it's this year, 2020 was already a mixed bag in general. But when it came to movies, that was also the case. Not this one, actually. It kind of hit all the right notes for me. I just really had a lot of fun with it. There was a lot of nice bits of humor, some really cool creatures, some exciting moments, some kind of creepy moments. There was moments that kind of really tugged at the heartstrings for me. It had a really good doggo. I like that. And it was, I just had fun with it. I really was really engrossed in it. You know, it just was a really fun film, and I really do, you know, hope it, you know, it seems to be doing well with the critics, but I hope that it, you know, finds more of an audience as time goes on, since it was denied its chance in the theaters. It's a fun film. It's not really horror at all. I mean, it has some, it's had creepy moments, but it's mostly a sci-fi adventure film with some comedy. I really am engrossed in it. I really love it a lot. And honestly, I think this is the film that I've been most looking forward to talking about as the 2020 has been going on. Yeah.
All right, very good. Yeah, for me, I actually think I heard about this film through Abe, because when it originally came out on VOD, suggested it as an episode, but as he mentioned, it was like one of those $20 or $25 rentals. You couldn't even buy it, I don't think. And then, of course, it became available to buy, but again, that was more expensive. And then now it's to the normal price of rental under, you know, like $6.99 and purchase $12.99. So yeah, I decided to buy it because it was getting good reviews. So I just paid it to $12.99, and I figured I'd watch it a few times. I went in completely blind, not knowing anything about it. And last week when we were trying to decide what film to do, we threw out a bunch of films, and then I just tossed this one out. And Mike said that he was up for it, and then everybody said, yeah, let's do it. So that's why we're doing it. It is an excellent film. It's really, really good. Fantastic acting, great special effects, very warm and heartwarming story, even if it is the apocalypse and 99% of the people are dead. It's actually more of a positive film than otherwise. And it has some good dark comedy or some comedy within a horror environment or a dystopian environment. So I would say high recommend. Everybody should see the film. It's PG-13, has some scary elements, but I decided to let my 5-year-old and 7-year-old to watch it. My 7-year-old wasn't too happy because she's scared of everything. So she just left the room. But my 5-year-old has watched it 5 or 6 times now. The first time she was very,
she's daddy's favorite.
The first watch she was very upset, and we'll discuss that one scene, but Mike may know what I'm going to talk about, what it is, but when we get to spoilery part, I'll bring it up. But high recommend, and absolutely great film. Mike.
I remember looking, I think I saw it when I was looking to actually go see a movie in the theaters, and I might have seen it pop up on one of those, like a Fandango or something that, and unfortunately was not playing anywhere near me. But I saw it had at the time, like a 91% Rotten Tomatoes score. And that seemed really weird to me because it's a movie that was called Love and Monsters, and I think the picture showed a monster, so it wasn't like a metaphorical monster. It was a movie with monsters with like a 90% something percent Rotten Tomatoes score. I kind of put it on my radar, and I was kind of waiting for the price to drop, and I would have paid to go see it in the theaters if it had dropped locally, but it never did. It never made it to AMC for some reason. So I watched it over Christmas break, and I really liked it. I think we have to address the elephant in the room and point out that this is very, very much Zombieland with giant monsters instead of zombies. But, Zombieland is now more than 10 years old, so this is what we call an homage as opposed to a ripoff. And it's a formula that works. And it's a fun film, and the actors are charming in it, so they're likable. You can get on board with rooting for their survival. And I think the monsters are really well done. It reminds me of any number of video games where you as a character are wandering the wasteland, perhaps with a canine companion, fighting off giant mutated beasts, maybe something like a Fallout, it's
a boy and his dog.
A boy and his dog, yeah. So it touches on all those tropes, just as I should point out, Zombieland touched on a lot of tropes there. And so I ended up liking it. I thought the script was really, really good. Everything is tight, everything's there with a purpose. Things tie into each other, and there are points that circle all the way around back home at the end. Groundwork is laid for stuff. This is what they, fundamentally good storytelling, which used to be much more commonplace in films. Like I said, it's just an enjoyable, feel good apocalypse film. This is the apocalypse I'd rather be living in right now.
All right. Sounds good. Eric.
I think the first time I heard about this is when I was exchanging title suggestions with Mr. Watson. And then it came up as a topic for an episode here. When Mr. Watson recommended this to me, I looked at it and I was like, that doesn't really seem like my kind of thing.
And unfortunately, I was right. I'm going to be the odd man out tonight. I didn't particularly care for this film. I can't point to anything and say they did a horrible job with that, because they didn't. The creature effects are certainly very well done. But the comedy didn't land for me, and I found the whole thing to be fairly predictable. The dog was awesome, but the dog got screwed. So I found the whole thing to be just a little flat for me personally. So I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I'm saying it wasn't for me. I probably won't revisit this.
All right, sounds good. So that's the four of us. Seems like three people liked it a lot, and one person was meh on it. So with that, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. All right. In a monster-infested world, Joel learns his girlfriend is just 85 miles away. To make the dangerous journey, Joel discovers his inner hero to be with the girl of his dreams.
All right. Sounds good. Well, the first thing I will say that I noticed and liked about the film was for 6 months later, or actually 7 years later, or whatever it is, actually, the grass is actually... It was grown, unlike zombie.
Oh yeah.
So
the first early season of The Walking Dead. Why is the grass always cut? You know.
Exactly. Yeah. So I every time, ever since I saw that in Walking Dead, and rolled my eyes, and laughed, I always check apocalypse films now to see if that's the case. And this one does not make that mistake. So well done by the makers of this film. What else? Does anybody want to bring up? Later we'll bring up the spoiler alert, talk about everything and anything. I will mention, my youngest daughter, 5, the thing that she was worried about was that the dog was going to die.
I honestly had that same feeling too. You know, I was like, oh, every time there's a dog companion, some kind of story like this, they usually get killed in some horrible way. And, you know, it's just like, it could have been such a cheap way to get, you know, the tears rolling and stuff like that. But, you know, we'll get to those little bits as we go along, you know, since we're not in spoilers just yet.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, my daughter was like almost in tears at one point, and I kept on saying, no, everything's fine. And thank God I was right.
We're
watching it first time together.
God damn it, I could have driven a permanent wedge between you and your daughter.
Yeah.
You lied to me, Daddy!
It was a couple of monsters she was scared of, too. And I said, no, these are friendly monsters. And sure enough, no. I lucked up. And it was a friendly monster. One of them was.
Two of them.
Yeah, two of them, right. And then, what else? And then after watching it the one time, now she can watch it without, like, freaking out, which is kind of funny. So she thinks she likes all the monsters and stuff.
Yeah, they're really cool. Yeah.
They sure are. Yeah. All right. So let's see what else we want to discuss. Mike was the one that mentioned before any of us else had seen the movie that the dog was a good dog, and he's right. It's a good dog.
Yeah, it's the best movie dog I've seen in a while. It's actually full sized.
Go to hell.
Can't put it into your pocket.
No stupid little dogs here.
Yeah. No. I mean, it does, even like the opening, and it's sometimes not a good sign when they feel the need to give the, like, the extended voiceover introduction. But I think they did a fun job showing that this, like, with this artwork and this animated segment. And it just kind of made an enjoyable opening credit sequence to go through and set up the world. But you mentioned the grass, and, you know, like, real world, you have limitations on budgets and things like that. But I think they did a great job painting this world, or at least digitally painting this world. And that just about every shot in the film, if there's a especially if it's like, you know, your Lord of the Rings walking over the terrain shot, there's something alien there, right? There's some sign. There's a hive. There's a burrow. There's something there to tell you that they did not just stick a camera, you know, in the valley and film something just where there was no people. They made sure they put something there to tell you it was an apocalypse, and it was apocalypse with giant monsters. And I thought that was really cool. I liked that. So it gave some good atmosphere to the film.
Yeah. It quickly sets the tone really fast. You know, it shows it's going to be more of a lighthearted sort of story. And it has, you know, even in terms of any violent scenes, it's very light as well. I mean, the most gruesome moment in terms of any human characters dying was more done in shadow. We never see anything explicit. Actually, you know, for a story about giant monsters, the human, you know, character death count was fairly low. I was actually surprised there. And you know, it's more about the adventure than any of the horror elements.
Yeah, exactly. It's an adventure, but it's also obviously a coming of age film.
Yeah,
a
character growth and stuff like that.
Yeah, a character growth film, even a character study if you really want to think about it. And stuff. So yeah, the horror aspect and the dystopian aspect is more just the setting of a bigger story. So I think that's what you were trying to allude to, right, Abe?
Yeah, it's all, because the main focus is the character development of our main character, you know, how he finally finds himself, and you know, part of it is literally breaking out of his shell, in a sense of that shell being the bunker that he has spent what, like 7 years with, inside with all of the others.
Abe, his personal demons from what he saw when the apocalypse first hit, as well as his own fear or freezing when danger happens to be near.
Well, what's really nice about it is that they don't try all cram everything, all those you know, revelations and those breakthroughs at the very last act. They kind of they do it really well over the course of the story. Like, for example, his freezing. Basically, our main character struggles whenever he freezes up and he begins to shake terribly. Something that we see and during the first monster encounter in the present events. It's so bad that the monster is able to literally just become inches from eating him. But what you would think he would be some scripts would make that something that would carry over to the entire thing to the very last act, but here it gets actually towards the midpoint. He figures out how to overcome it, and we also even see a reason for why that is when he loses his parents. So we see a cause, but we also see the breakthrough. But it's paid off in a good way that doesn't feel contrived.
Yeah. Also, another thing too. He is a dreamer, and he has to correct that and become more of a realist as well. That basically because how he's waiting for 7 years for one individual, and his life is being passed by as everybody else couples up or has important jobs, and then he has this. He's like the dreamer who wants to correct that because he has a focus on one individual, an ex-girlfriend. And then by the end of the film, he kind of wakes up and begins living in the present rather than in a real present and a hopeful present rather than a dream
because one thing we see in this film is that it's not just him. It's a lot of people who are kind of hoping for everything, all this to kind of just blow over. To find that somebody else will clean up the mess and things will go back to as they were. But that never happens. And, you know, when we kind of, I kind of compare it to some serious crises around the world and stuff like that, where people kind of sit, stand by, or kind of sit and wait for someone else to figure out, you know, what, how to fix something. But there are times in life that you have to kind of step forward yourself and try to make that change in your life, rather than just like wait for it to happen.
That's right. That's right. And even if that change is a mistake, which kind of is in his case, it opens up other doors and avenues to his life after his goal, he finds out, was more a dream or a mirage than an actual possibility, in a sense. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because he has this goal, he decides to go for the goal, and in a different movie, the goal would have ended the way he would have hoped, but it doesn't. And what it does instead makes him a different person, and a wiser person, and a person with, I guess, better goals or more important goals than the original goal that kind of led him on the journey in the first place.
Yeah. He grows as a person, and he's a person who's been stagnating. And it's so easy, especially during a lockdown, for that to happen. And I think it's human nature for us to say, I'd like to do a thing, and let either find excuses not to do it, or let our inhibitions and anxieties stop us from doing it. And I'm just as guilty of that as I think most people are, maybe more so because I've never drank or used drugs to give me that instant courage. But, you know, sometimes you just, you know, it's what the fear is the thing holding you back more than the actual obstacle itself. And a lot of times our fears are silly. You know, what is the worst that's really going to happen? And oftentimes it's, you know, really not much. You might be embarrassed for a little bit, you know. And they make the point, there's nothing special about this guy. It's if you've ever seen a motivational speaker, they say the same thing. If I can do it, anybody can do it, right? It's, you know, there's nothing special about what he does. He admits he's terrible at this, but yet he was able to do it. So if I can do it, you can do this. We can go out. We can retake the world. And the world is full of people who tells us what we can't do. You know, you think about the people he's with in the bunker. It's, he's got a weirdly it's nice to see that he's the odd man out in the bunker, but they still seem to love him and care about him and be looking out for him. But they also have no faith in him, right? Because they've seen him for 7 years freeze up at every instant. So they know him. And so when he goes out and does a thing, they're kind of like, eh, we don't think it's a good idea. And they do everything they can to talk him out of it. And sometimes our loved ones in life can do that. They'll say, don't go, don't do that. It's, you know, don't pursue that career because you'll never be able to make a living at it. Or whatever it might be. So I appreciate that. I appreciate that it's that he does get his goals and finds out maybe they're not what he really wanted. And also appreciating what you have. There's all sorts of things in there that you can pick apart. And it's nothing revelatory, right? It's not like it's saying a thing that many, many other films haven't said before, but it's human nature and it says it well. With giant yes, monsters. Indeed.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely. All right. Also, I have to say that this is a film I feel has done two things with actor Michael Rooker. They didn't typecast him, and I think they used his wonderful acting ability better than probably any film I've ever seen since his debut film, Henry, A Portrait of a Serial Killer. And it was good to see that, because usually he plays very bit parts or heavies or something of that nature. While here, for the screen time that he was in the film, he was like really a focus of the film, and it shows how, in my opinion, misused he's been in so many films, because he has a really good presence and acting ability that could work if he could find bigger parts, I think.
Well, he gets to show range here, right? And he's sort of a father figure to this girl. And so you can see him kind of in that role, see him in a mentor role. He's not in a heavy role, you know, in a bad guy role. And they do offer moments. One of the things I do like is that they don't – I don't think they – well, it's a feel-good apocalypse movie. And, you know, there's only so, you know, so much you can do with that in terms of ignoring the underlying issues. But they do address often and touch back on the fact that everyone there has suffered traumatic loss. And, you know, so when you see Michael Rooker and this girl, we're supposed to assume this is this girl with her father or grandfather. And we find out that no, you know, that she's lost her parents and he's lost his son. And they're just two people who found each other in the apocalypse. You know, that this isn't like since having brought up Zombieland, right, that this isn't like Wichita and Little Rock, who were the, you know, the two sisters who are stuck together. You know, these are just two hurting souls that have found something in each other, and that gives you something to play with.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And and Michael Rooker kind of becomes a father figure to this kid too.
Yeah,
at the time they,
yes,
they were together.
And, I mean, because throughout this entire film, he is the only human. Because I'm pointing out, because for a later scene, parental figure that he meets throughout the entire film, gives him any sort of lessons and guidance.
Right.
The moments between those two and, of course, the young girl Minnow, kind of show case of moments of a family, but it kind of also highlights that how our protagonist doesn't seem to realize that he already had one back at the bunker as well. Because there's one thing Minnow mentions to him is that you shouldn't settle. You know, you shouldn't settle one single thing or one single person to make you happy. Because it's, you know, there's so much out there. And that's one thing that he and also just the people around the world start to kind of realize that staying locked up or settling for one kind of thing, one existence, won't make you happy, won't change things. But if you look hard enough, you'll find something that maybe you realize you've had all along, or you might discover something new.
That's true. That's true. Go on.
As some wise men once said, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need.
You get what you need!
Yeah, and the Michael Rooker character kind of is the person that's referenced throughout the film, even after his scenes, because he learns, our lead character learns so much from Michael Rooker's character, and through overlaying sound, he talks about how, all right, similar to like Zombieland, rule number 47, you know, room whatever, and, right, and they're all referenced back to the Michael Rooker character, who has shown that he's been able to survive in this world. And another thing that I kind of liked about this film too is a couple of things, and that's the monsters aren't evil; they're just
animals,
predators. Yeah, they're just animals, and basically they even say it pretty quick. Michael Rooker says it. He goes, we have to deal with the fact that we're not at the top of the food chain anymore. So they're just animals. And the other thing I liked is that, except for three characters near the end of the film, everybody in the film is decent people. So this apocalypse, the people have basically created societies where they – respect the humanity of their fellow survivors. It's not like the typical dystopian, like Mad Max or Walking Dead or whatever.
Or people, A Boy and His Dog.
Yeah, or A Boy and His Dog, which actually started it all, to be honest. That was the first one. And where the people are all insane and are evil and warring. Or, for example, another movie, Mike, that we're going to be doing that we picked tonight, The Stand miniseries. There's another one. You know, so this here, the people are all good.
Why Eric isn't connecting with the film. The people don't really suck, and they're just not authentic enough.
I don't like Happy Apocalypse, Mamby Pamby. Give me The Road.
Right. That's how it would really be.
People who eat people.
that movie was unbelievably awesome. For different reasons. And it was authentic. It could have been a true historical document of how people will act in the future.
Right.
Let me set up the film before we throw up the spoiler. But yeah, basically what it is a meteor that's going to hit the Earth 7 years prior. And we have our lead character played by Dylan O'Brien, or Joel, the character's name is. So, and he's 23 at this point because he was 16 when it happened, and this is 7 years later. And what happens is the various governments in the world use missiles to shoot the asteroid or meteor up so it won't hit the Earth, and that works. Unfortunately, the chemicals that were used in the weapons, the missiles, fall back to Earth, and they cause mutations to the various amphibians, reptiles, and insects, arachnids. So basically, anything, crustaceans, you name it, that type of creature.
Anything cold-blooded. Yeah.
Oh, that's the word.
Cold-blooded.
Absolutely.
Anti-cold-blooded. I'm sorry. I just have to say this whole premise is horse shit.
Well, I was just about to say, Eric, it reminds me of Snowpiercer, okay. Where it's an absolutely – it is a ludicrous premise, but it's worth it to get to the premise. And, well, zombies are enough of a trope at this point that you don't even need to explain it. You just say, and we're in a zombie apocalypse, the same way you start off with saying, and they were in the shopping mall, because we just accept it now because it's been used so much. If you want to do that, you can start in the middle of it, as you kind of did with Zombieland. I think you're right. It's a ludicrous premise, but it's to get us to an awesome setup.
And no, I get it. I just had to say it for the record. And I don't even necessarily have a problem with there being chemicals that cause this to happen. I have a problem with them putting those chemicals in the missiles they're shooting in an asteroid to blow it up. That makes no goddamn sense whatsoever.
I could have sworn it had something to do with chemicals or something in the meteor.
No, but they say in the movie it's chemicals in the weapons, which is weird.
That's what they're trying to say is it was – like Godzilla. So nuclear power. So man's chemicals rather than nuclear power created giant monsters.
What they needed was a reason for it to be global rather than local. So fine, whatever. I'm just saying it's silly.
Do I get giant monsters? Then that's fine with me. I understand it's But I like you said, it's an absurd premise, and there are no people.
And it's silly. I mean, vampires are silly. Werewolves are silly.
I have an aunt who doesn't like anything fantasy like that. They're just silly and ridiculous. And when it's not somewhat grounded in reality, just can't get past it. Right. So a movie like this or whatever is she just can't enjoy it. Some people have that mindset, and some of us lean into it and podcast about it 52 times a year.
My wife is similar to that too. I did get her into the zombie films for a little bit because it was like a disease apocalypse, but now she's even bored of them. So but otherwise, yeah, like anything fantasy, science fiction or anything like that, she has no interest to see. So you're right, it depends on the people, and we do it 52 times a year. But Eric made the point, and it is noted. It's a valid point. So what happens is that he lives in a bunker, and he's the cook, makes minestrone soup. And the reason he's the cook is because he can't fight because he freezes, as Abe mentioned. And he's never decided to find a girlfriend or a mate because everybody else there is, has paid up. And the reason for that is his girlfriend from prior to the apocalypse is alive 80 miles away at another bunker. And so he's staying true to her, even though he only gets to talk to her on a CB radio, because obviously she's 80 miles away, and to get there is kind of tough with giant monsters all over the place. But everybody
can
else
I say I think they're seriously downplaying the importance and value of having a good cook amongst your crew in the apocalypse.
And I agree. No,
I think they're shortchanging that role.
Yeah,
I think they are.
I mean, because you're going to get so far with canned foods and shit.
Right, he slipped that human meat in there, and they didn't even notice.
Right.
More than that, Abe. It's canned food at least has flavor, so he has to take raw food and turn that into something.
Well,
that,
what I'm saying is that once you go through all the preservatives and stuff like that, you're gonna have to forage and take raw materials and make them into food. Which makes me wonder, after he left, how did they manage?
Well, it's again, the other people could have cooked. It's just that wasn't their job, and he happened to get that job by default because he couldn't fight.
And as the minestrone was really the thing that he was good at. I don't think they said they didn't say like he made a mean brisket or chicken cordon bleu. You know, it's I do think in his case it was just it's the one thing he can do is make minestrone, you know, just
So that's pretty much the setup of the film, and then we get an example of him freezing up where there's a breach in the bunker. Something gets in and it's an insect, giant insect, and to prove that he's not scared, he decides to help out because they see on radar one of their people getting killed or taken by the insect. And then, of course, he freezes and he is about to get killed. And someone saves him. And that kind of wakes him up to say that I'm useless and I got to do something with my life. So why don't I go to my woman 80 miles away? And, you know, have the quote unquote mate or whatever, and be somebody, and that's why he decides to do his journey, and that's pretty much the setup, right?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward, I think one of the things really nice is that everything is quickly established as to, you know. It sets up the world, it sets up the motivation, the destination, and, you know, sets those pieces up, and everything between from that point on is also the important elements of development and world building. The world building I thought was really well done. I thought the world was really interesting in the sense you kind of get little snippets of how the ecosystem has changed from the 7 years, you see like eggs and stuff like that laying around, animals making certain like pools and stuff like that, their habitat. It's really cool, subtle little bits of world building. And it kind of gets a little crazy. Like for one moment, there's a night scene where we actually see moon jellies, flying jellyfish, which was cool. Really weird, but I liked it. It was really interesting. It kind of shows how they kind of have some really creative little ideas of just making expanding the world and just kind of adding a little bit of magic alongside the more horrific entities.
Right. And also, even before the apocalypse, even though we don't see it, but we're told about it, and we see it after the apocalypse, similar to Fallout video games, Mike, they have Mavis robots. A robot called Mavis is that are basically, I guess, helper robots that every home had. So it's either sometime in the future. So the apocalypse didn't happen in 2021. The apocalypse happened probably years later, or it's an alternate timeline. But either way, there's robots in people's houses prior to the apocalypse.
I get the sense that because, again, it's been 7 years and nobody there is like 16, right? So they've all lived in the world and remember the world pretty well. And they all seem excited that later in the film he finds a Mavis and he interacted with it, and they all seem excited and interested about it. So my sense is this was probably like a thing that was just rolling out.
You know,
like the very first iPhones or yeah. You know, the first PlayStation 5s. Ooh, what's it like to have it? And so they never quite got to like the full saturation of the robot units you get in Fallout. But it's still a thing there. And it's a nice little thing they put in there. They do set it up early, which I appreciate. They could have just had it come out of nowhere, which would have been weird. But they do set it up with them shooting one at the beginning of the film. And you know, she sort of serves a story, a character development purpose. And it's a weird little scene. It's a nice little scene.
That was the other thing I mentioned about the almost parental role, outside of, you know, Cap and the Minnow, but this case here is almost like a mother or a more adult figure. It's a robot, but the way it's programmed to be empathetic and kind of almost a consultant you can talk to. And it's very advanced. It's portrayed as being a very advanced robot to have a full on conversation. But the scene was really nice. It was strange and very different, but it was really, I thought, really well done. I thought the performance done by the voice work of the person who portrayed the robot and our lead actor really did a really nice conversation of him opening up and, you know, sharing his thoughts and his insecurities and stuff like that. And it was just a nice moment. It's just a nice little event of, you know, further pushing that development and growth. And you know, it was actually also a nice little quiet moment after an intense monster sequence with the centipede, which is also another moment of character growth for him where he finally breaks out of his freeze, where he actually saves the dog boy from nearly getting eaten, you know, because he remembers when he felt helpless and not being able to save his parents. So I just liked how each thing is paid off in some way, and how he finally, you know, conquers fears, also opens up to old wounds and stuff like that. It's just nice and fleshed out, and just nice. And every scene feels like it has a purpose in this journey. Nothing feels throwaway.
Right. Yeah, and even Mavis, the robot, kind of makes him become more human and empathetic too, in a sense, because even though he generally is throughout the film, Mavis sacrifices herself in a non violent way. In other words, she doesn't sacrifice herself because there's a monster there and the robot throws itself at the monster, but she sacrifices herself in a different way, which is almost as I guess important to him if she had saved him physically. And so I think that kind of had him grow, because he sees how a robot was selfless. And I kind of think that's how what made him the way he was when he finally gets to his destination and what he does to not just try to help his prior girlfriend, but the entire community when he gets there. As well, well as also, never mind going back to his original community.
Yeah. Well, there's also a very important moment where she poses some questions to him as that, you know, like how things might turn out, you know, possible scenarios, you know, and one that was, you know, set up him, for, you know, the expectation of disappointment that, you know, his reunion with his girlfriend might not go the way he thinks it's going to go. You know, it's kind of important lesson he kind of learns that, you know, things change and, you know, how things might play out, you how you want them may not really happen in that way. And you just got to learn to accept things change and, you know, sometimes you have to move on.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. All right, so any specific scenes anybody wanted to discuss? I mean, we don't have to go scene by scene or anything like that, but, I mean, we've been generally talking. Yeah, go on, Mike.
So one of the nice things is, I mean, the standout scenes do tend to be the monster scenes because, you know, loving monsters. I think they gave you good variety and escalation with the monsters. So you start, the first one you see is the giant ant in the underground tunnel.
Yeah.
But you don't really get a great look at it. It's mostly kept in shadow or never quite comes fully in frame. We get the giant frog, but there's like a general escalation in terms of the challenge and the difficulty, which, you know, very video game like. You know, but they all kind of help serve something of a purpose to the characters, show something the characters learning. Or give you something for later on. There's the boulder snail, right? Which I thought was a kind of a neat thing. I do understand that they changed the ending of the film where it was supposed to have Cthulhu.
Oh, lordy, really?
But it was from a thing I had watched about the film. They were going to have Cthulhu or something Cthulhu-like at the end. Where we, you know, we get a giant crab, and I think they changed it because of underwater.
Oh yeah, right, that movie.
Surprise, nobody watched Underwater, but that's okay. Not enough to, I think, force them to do whatever reshoots. I don't know if they changed much of the story other than what the creature looked like, or if the, you know, how much of that final act was different. But I think what was there worked fine, and I thought it was nice because it was one of those Chekhov's monster eyes that was set up earlier in the film, and I completely forgot about it by the time we got to that scene.
Yeah, but at least down the thing of how they, as you said, they set things up ahead of time. They don't do a sudden just out of nowhere that he'd be like, "Oh, I suddenly understand this crab now." There's just little things there that are each paid off in some way. Like they mentioned the burrowing queen, which they mentioned there's this alpha kind of burrowing monster, which is almost like this horrible love child of a grab boy from Tremors and a hagfish that starts attacking them, you know.
Well, and honestly, this is, I mean, you guys are talking about setting up and paying off, but really, for me, that was one of my issues with the movie, is that they talk about that thing, and I'm just like, gee, I wonder if we're going to be saying that later.
Well, yeah, but I mean, and you're right, and there, I said, this is a very formulaic film, but formulas are formulas in part because they work. Mm-hmm. And I think they work more than plot twists that maybe come out of nowhere, or things that you set up and never pay off, or, you know, when they just kind of reveal at the last minute, oh, hey, I can do this thing that I never happened to mention any point ever in the film before and will never mention again. The whole Chekhov's gun thing is there for a reason, and this film does have a lot of it. The berries is another example.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I'm not gonna disagree with you that it's formulaic. It is absolutely formulaic, but I think it's a formula that works, and it does give them a competent story. And I've I'm kind of tired of seeing some stories just feel like fail on basic storytelling.
I hear what you're saying. I want to talk about what a raw deal this dog got. Because, I mean, this dog, he's a good doggo. And he has one thing in life he loves more than anything else, and that's that dress. All he wants is his dress. And he was just chilling, minding his own business, happy with his dress, until this dude comes along. And eventually makes him lose the dress and screams at him. And now he doesn't have his dress anymore. And it's all that dude's fault.
Well, he did get the dress back. And the dress...
He didn't have it when he showed up at the beach.
For folks who are confused, the dress was his prior master's dress and all that the dog remembers of his prior master, because his prior master is obviously killed by the bugs or cold-blooded monsters. But he did leave with the dress when they separated.
He didn't have it at the end of the movie.
He didn't have it when he came onto the beach. You're absolutely right. But he still had the dress when he left the...
Which was before the beach, which means he didn't have it at the end of the movie. Doesn't have his dress all because of this jerk.
Maybe he gave the dress to a pretty girl he found.
I mean, a pretty guy.
I want to judge.
We don't know if he lost the dress. They never...
I am confident in my assessment.
He could have just buried the dress someplace safe.
Right, or left it inside the cave.
When he doesn't have his dress anymore, and it's all that dude's fault.
I don't know. I mean, I
don't know. I think the dog had to move on. As a lot
exactly.
of blood.
The dog had a story arc. I can't believe you missed it, Eric.
Oh, that's my bad.
No, it's fun, right? And the dog character like saves his life. It was a nice little thing they do early because it points out the thing with the berries. And I was certainly under the impression that the thing with the berries was
Chekhov's gun.
Well, I mean, it was just a thing to show that how kind of out of it he was in that world, and that the dog was going to help him survive, and the use of the dog as a companion, and then it really does kind of come back around. There were other things, for example, and to absolutely piggyback what Eric said, there is a scene where for some weird reason Michael Rooker just happens to say, "Oh, and by the way, those blades of grass over there, if you eat those will be great as an anti-venom."
Yeah. Right. Then he did bring that up pretty randomly.
And I'm just mentioning
it's a fascinating
trivia point I read in the Times last night.
Actually, before you continue, I think it was because he was doing his book and he was giving him the tips for the book.
Right, but it's like the one. It was highlighted in a way that it was like putting sparklers around it. That's saying this is a Chekhov's gun, unlike I think with the berries. Whereas like
now,
let's say
about the time or something? Okay,
I was saying like if they had three different things he had pointed out, and one of those things played out later, right? So you buried it a little bit.
Right.
I think it was. I'm just saying it was ham-handed. I think the rest of it's not like a ruin the movie moment by any stretch, but it is kind of a roll your eye kind of moment because you see where that's going.
One of my favorite monster scenes was actually the giant centipede.
Yeah.
That was actually a really eerie scene because basically there's this moment where the dog gets upset by some kind of noise. It's causes it to hide under some duck statue, something like that.
It's a playground.
It was a penguin escape vehicle from Batman Returns.
It was shaped as a giant duck, and it was basically for kids to climb on in the playground. And
yeah,
there's a little tunnel underneath it, and the dog hides under it.
You're right. Anyways, basically, there's a sound. It sounds like clinking, like metal clinking together. All of a sudden, we see these little legs pop up all around them. And basically, it's this giant-ass fucking centipede. It looks like it came out of the prehistoric ages, and all its legs are clicking together, making this horrible, like, scraping metal sound. It's actually really eerie. And it starts to snake around them, and it's a really cool-looking monster, and it has, like, pretty much these lamprey-like tongues that come out of it. it was really a nice little moment, because it also it is what that big event that also pays off where he finally takes out a monster, which was a really awesome epic moment.
Well, it also, you know what it was awesome about it too, Abe, is that the dog becomes him, right? The dog becomes frozen. And so he now has to become the person that he always wanted to be, which is someone that has to fight his own fears and fight to survive and fight to help or save someone that he loves, which is the dog.
And I don't know if the dog was frozen so much as it didn't have anywhere to go, but I see your point.
And it also didn't have a weapon.
It has his teeth. Those are them are good teeth.
It's not going to work on the shell of a giant centipede.
Either way, it was right. My point is that it can't do anything, and it's basically dead. And this is where my daughter almost started crying. She was screaming. She literally screamed. I was like, holy shit, maybe I shouldn't be. Oh, I don't know why. And I'm going, no, the dog is fine.
Taxi driver instead.
She said, right, yeah, exactly. She was like, oh, my God, the dog is dead. The dog. And I go, no, the dog's not dead. And I'm just fingers crossed that the dog's not dead. And sure enough,
that
the dog,
would be a mess to clean up.
And how old is she now?
5. And so my mother.
Yeah, that's a little bit too old to pull the old. No, the dog has just gone off to be somewhere else safe and right. Have her actually believe it, you know?
Right. Just like, I forget the name of the horse and The Never Ending Story. Oh, she's just.
Vortex, yeah.
It just went swimming. He's not dead.
He got better.
Yeah.
Could you imagine if that was the point the dog died? You had a mess of cleanup right there.
My wife would have killed me. Well, you have to watch this film. So that I lucked out there. But I kind of knew the dog wasn't going to die because I mentioned it when we chose the film, because Mike said, oh, this is a good dog. Oh, Phil will like it because of a dog. I go, oh, no, don't tell me the dog's going to die. And you go, no, the dog's just good dog. So I was like, okay. Mike would have been kind of rubbing it in if it actually did die.
Yeah, I would have been. Or I would have not told you that because I wanted you to feel the pain of heartbreak. But I wouldn't do that to your daughters. So I would have felt somewhat bad about it. Although then I would have put myself in denial mode and said, well, it was your fault for making them watch it without you watching it first.
That's true.
And I would have reassured myself that way and absolved myself of any possible guilt.
That's not denial mode, Mike. That's truth mode.
Well, the reason I let them watch it was because when I was I was skimming through some reviews, and one of them said, oh, no, it was on Wikipedia page. I think, it gives the little clips from what the critics thought. And one of the lines they said is, as a family-friendly film, I said, all right, then I guess the kids can watch it. So then it was a little more intense than I thought, but they did pretty good.
Yeah. I honestly felt that the payoff with the centipede was much more interesting than the worm thing.
Yeah.
I
agree. That the centipede scene, I felt, was the scariest and the most stressful. While the worm thing came second and was kind of anticlimactic because it came second.
But I also think with the worm, the graboid, let's just call it what it is, I don't think that's what you want as your first kill, right? Because now you're beating the boss without having faced the rest of the level. You know,
The centipede kind of felt more of a boss, is what I was thinking. I think, right, Abe?
Yeah, it was. As I said, it was more. I felt the scene was much more atmospheric because it was dark. It was creepy. It just felt. And as I said, it went back to the demons he was fighting about freezing up. You know, so the payoff, the thing that he had was dealing with beforehand, he finally conquers and saves somebody he cares about. You know, it was a really cool moment. But the worm, I think another issue I kind of will agree with Mike on one thing, when in terms of being ham-fisted, kind of like Chekhov's gun, was the grenade.
Yeah, that was kind of a Chekhov's gun. Yeah. And it's also the scene that Eric probably hated the most, because this is when he screws over the dog.
I mean, everything up until the point where he yells at the dog is fine.
You know, it's like, I don't know. It's just like, oh, he's going to use that grenade at some point, of course.
Right.
And, And it just so happens to be the very giant worm monster they mentioned earlier. It's like, oh, okay.
Well, yeah. Whether it's a Chekhov's gun or not, it's the smart thing, right? I mean, you only have one grenade. You're probably going to use it only sparingly and in last case, right? And this was the last case, right?
Yeah.
It had a coming together of Chekhov's grenade and Chekhov's giant worm monster.
Oh, and also Chekhov's poison too.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Chekhov's
antidote.
Chekhov's antidote.
Right? But yeah, it was just a moment where everything, too many little little breadcrumbs came together too quickly.
Yeah, the only thing in this movie that wasn't completely predictable is that he gets there, and she's like, "Yeah, thanks, but I've moved on."
Yeah, because she actually never told him, so let him go, egg them on for 7 years. When she was already married to someone else, basically, until that person got killed and had moved on. And she made him think that she was still waiting for him. And then she admits that I never thought you would make it anyway. So I just needed you to talk.
No,
to
she was basically. She was with somebody else, she said.
Yeah, she said, my heart is with someone else who died. I moved on.
Okay. And,
yeah. And so. Yet for 7 years she was talking to him, leading him on in a sense.
In what sense?
Well, she should have just. She knew damn well that he was waiting for her, and she had moved on, and she should have just told him.
Having a conversation
on the radio.
Yeah. Every day, every other day, or whatever, and so she knew that he wasn't married, that he was wait, you know. We're going to get together again sometime and all that. Well, she was lying to him on the radio because she was already with someone else for 5 years before that person unfortunately died from a monster. And
well, we didn't hear the conversation, so I don't know how that went. It probably would have been a good thing to bring up, but I also understand what are the odds that they're ever actually going to see each other
during their conversation.
No, but that's not the point. You're right, the odds. But then she should have said, don't wait for me. You don't find someone else because – the odds that you're ever going to get here is probably zero, but she didn't do any of that. And she knew probably and whatnot that he hadn't paired up with anybody because he was waiting for her or waiting to get to her
mm-hmm.
for 7 years.
I don't, but we don't know like that. He ever made it clear he was waiting for her.
Exactly.
We don't know what the conversations were. And I think it's best
but
that way because
we are talking 7 years, and he didn't know that she was already married to some other guy for 5 years. And she,
well, I don't know. I don't think they spoke to each other for the full 7 years.
No, I think they managed to get radio broadcast between the two camps once in a while, because certain people he talks to he recognizes. Like, so there wasn't too many conversation between them, but I don't think it was for all that time. And there's also another point where she even says she wasn't even sure he was even going to come over.
Right, but that's what she said after he arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And so she should have said, in other words, he was basically telling her that I'm going to, see you. And she told him, yeah, but I never thought it was going to happen. And she should have probably told him, I moved on.
Well, definitely before he actually made the trip. And she says as much during that conversation.
Right. But she should have said it way before, whenever they first started talking, she should have said, I'm actually with someone else or I was. And unfortunately he passed or whatever, but she never did. He didn't know. He was completely clueless. He thought she was waiting for him. For 7 years,
you're jumping to a conclusion there.
I don't think so, because why else would he say, I'm coming, I'm going to see my girl and be with my girl? Unless.
You hear him say that?
Delusional man is delusional? Never seen that before.
Yeah, he did say that. He most certainly said that. So.
He didn't say it to her.
No, I understand that, but. Anyway, but I made my point. I mean, we can move on.
If you say so.
About it. how didn't I make my point, Eric?
Tonight, Crossfire.
You're making about half a dozen assumptions about what we didn't see. That's all.
basically, that's why they had the voiceovers. He explained it all in voiceovers.
I didn't hear a lot of what you just explained in voiceovers. Let's move on.
Okay, we can move on. All right, so what else we want to discuss? Anything else?
I liked the crab. The crab was pretty cool.
Yeah, special effects were really, really awesome in the crab. And that's the thing. That whole scene kind of reminded me of Ray Harryhausen stuff. I mean, it was pretty solid. Mm. I think they did it better than George Lucas did in the clone film.
Okay. No, that crab looked fantastic, especially during that one shot where he's looking into its eyes. I was like, damn, that actually looks like an animal. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh, there's another Chekhov's gun looking into the eyes to know if a monster is a threat or not.
Yep.
I also loved just watching it eat the pirates. Just fucking eat them like fucking popcorn.
Yeah, revenge. Vengeance.
They had it coming.
Yep, the death sentence. They had it coming for sure. Yeah, that's right. Because they murdered probably scores of people. You know,
during that whole fight scene, I was ready to rip it apart for one particular reason, because I didn't understand something when it started, which is with the blonde lady. I did not understand that the weapon she had was a grenade launcher. I thought it was like a submachine gun.
When the
one girl charges her with a piece of metal or whatever and knocks her down, they get up and they start doing hand-to-hand combat. I'm like, she's holding an Uzi. Why doesn't she just fucking shoot her?
Right. Yeah, and I felt that one scene really bothered me too, because she's running with a metal tray or whatever, and bounces the bullets off the tray.
Hey,
but again, they weren't bullets. They were, it did work for Clint Eastwood. You're absolutely right. But they weren't bullets. they were grenades, mini grenades, and they just hadn't gone off, right? Because
I think it was somebody else shooting at her.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, all right. So that scene, either way, obviously that was just luck. But you're right. Yeah, it was a grenade launcher, not a Uzi. Or M9.
No, so that salvaged it for me, because that until it became clear that it was a grenade launcher, I was just like, this is such complete horse shit.
right. Yeah. Now, the thing I was confused about, why were the pirates... Pirates. They had it good. They could have just moved in and took over that, and you know, been part of the community. But instead,
because they don't want to share those resources.
Yeah, I guess so. That's
it's another kind of funny thing. Is there's a running gag about food stealers. Throughout the story, our main character, if multiple times, gets wonder.
It was a
like,
three beat.
Exactly. It was like, you know, why are you calling me? Did you steal food? And like, no. And then another person asked, Demon the Robot asked, did you steal food? No. Why do you keep asking that? Until finally they actually meet a real food stealer.
Right. So basically what happens is, usually when people aren't in a community or in a bunker, it's because they were thrown out because they were stealing other people's food. And that's the running joke, is that everybody thinks he stole food. That's the reason why he's out in alone in the wilderness, when in fact that's not what it is. It's he has to keep on explaining, no, I'm heading to another community to be with someone I know there. And then you know that, and what was it, they say, oh, love, and he goes, yeah. So
that's an even dumber reason.
Yeah, especially with a woman that didn't even like him. But a running, that was the running joke. Yeah, I thought that was a funny running joke. It was good. I smiled and laughed at each time it came up.
You mean the robot accusing you?
Right. That was awesome. Let's see, what else? Yeah, so that was the plan of the pirates, right? Is that they had the giant crab attached to an electric generator.
How the hell they got that crab hooked up on that chain to begin with.
It was a friendly crab, and they tricked it.
I'll accept that answer.
It's more likely they took advantage of its docile nature and trapped it. Because it seems like they used it to drag their ship around through the coastal waters to keep going to colonies.
That's exactly what they did.
They
took prisoners and they fed the crab the prisoners.
Oh, they weren't even prisoners. They were fuel for the crab because the crab was essentially their engine.
The moral of the story is never trust anybody. Always assume everybody's going to hook you up to a chain and electrocute you.
Or feed you to
definitely don't trust people with crabs.
Oh.
Yeah. So anytime you see any human being out there, expect that they have crabs.
Unless you look deeply into the crab's eyes.
That's right. And then you know the crabs are friendly crabs.
And as we all know, the other lesson is that when there's a person who is taller, handsomer, funnier, and smarter than the hero,
they're the bad guy.
They must be evil and must be destroyed.
Especially when they have a Australian or English or New Zealand accent.
Oh, absolutely.
Damn you, Australians!
Well, I mean, damn it, they're a colony of criminals, for Christ's sake.
That's the original. That's how it started, yeah.
Don't blame me for your genealogy.
Yeah, that's true. What else do we want to talk about? Any other scenes that we missed or growing points by the main character or anything like that? Anything?
Well, I did think it was interesting and for Cap, right? Now, when I saw Michael Rooker show up, and I did not know at the time he was in this film, but when I saw him show up in, again, the Zombieland comparisons were already there, and so the Tallahassee comparison immediately up to mind. But I was surprised that he exited the film, but I think as early as he did. But I think that was kind of an important thing because otherwise they would have just stretched out the character's empowerment goal for like the next act. It would have until like the end of the film. And the first thing he would have done is try to stand up to the crab monster, which is not what we wanted to see. He needed to have his training wheels taken off. So I think it worked for the character arc to remove those two. They teach him what they need to, and then they move on.
Well, and they also recommend him to go with them, and that would have been probably the smarter move. Obviously, the dog felt that way. And he decided not to, which made him also grow as a character because he decides to do his original goal rather than the quote-unquote easier goal, which would have been to stay with Clyde and Minnow, I felt. But I do see your point where at that point in the film, Rooker's character was most certainly an equal and Minnow as well in storytelling for a while. I mean, they were real important characters, even if it was in his perspective. So... And that was the thing. I was wondering, were they going to die or not, right? And unfortunately, we got the coda to find out that they survived and that they're waiting for them.
Just got to be careful of the snow spiders.
That's right. Do you think he'll make it? Nah, he's not going to make it.
I did keep thinking that Rooker was going to pull an Obi-Wan moment, you know, if he stuck around for the story or something like that.
Oh, it's suicide, yeah.
You know, something was going to happen to him because of the. A lot of times, if you're a mentor to any main character, you're probably fucked.
Oh, they had to keep him around to kill him off in the sequel.
Well, that's one thing about this film is that all the characters that you like, none of them died. I like, oh, that was good.
Yeah, the only one who dies are the pricks at the end of the film.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly.
Even the old people were able to outrun the giant crab.
Exactly. Yep. Well, right, because the crab really didn't want to kill any of them anyway. He just wanted to be let go.
the crab is the true misunderstood Night King.
Yeah, that was honest, yeah. It sure was. Yeah.
The crab died for our sins.
Oh, Minnow. No, he didn't die. The crab survived.
I know, it's a joke.
Minnow said, "Hey, stole my line." I thought that was a funny little joke at the end. Because he's radioing people to go to the mountains that Rooker recommended. Yep. And they're listening and they hear it on the radio and whatnot. So, so I think he's going to make it. I think they're going to make the mountains because the reason they're going to the mountains, Rooker is smart. He says we're going to the mountains because it's colder up there. And since these are cold blooded animals, they're less to
be
up there. Yeah.
Except for snow spiders, apparently.
Yeah. Except for snow spiders.
Yeah, but there is a thing called mass endothermy where larger animals retain heat better, you know, so I don't know. I don't know that they would be as turned off by the cold, at least in short bursts. Were they heading all the way up to Canada, or were they just heading up the side of a mountain?
They're just heading up the side of a mountain.
Yeah, they can walk up and come back down to warm up later. I don't think it's going to work as well as he thinks they will, but that's okay.
I do hope that this movie is a standalone. I don't think it really needs a sequel.
I think it's already in development.
Is really? Yeah. God. After seeing what happened with Zombieland 2, I'm just kind of
Well, to be frank, most movies don't need a sequel.
Most movies didn't need to be made in the first place.
Well, that's also true. But Hollywood is lazy, so they would much rather develop an existing property than come up with something new.
What I would actually like, I want a copy of the book, because I would like to see the
book. Oh, me too, actually. I really want to see it.
I would like a copy of the book. The book. The book of monsters, the art book.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
I would like that, number one. And number two, I would like the video game.
Yeah, that would be an awesome video game, actually.
They're already there, but, I think, you know, that certainly the potential is there for that.
So you're saying that there already is they've already decided greenlit a sequel.
A lot of the way these things work, everything has it there. I think they have greenlit the sequel. There is certainly talk about it. But we'll see, because sometimes things fall apart because of scheduling or because change in executives. So until it actually begins production, that's when it'll be there, but I think there are already plans for it.
Interesting. All right. It is a good film, so and I could see a lot of people liking it because it's action adventure, sci-fi without any real your favorite characters getting killed, and it's not dark. So
until sequel.
Well, that's the thing where they screw up the sequel. I mean, at least the good thing about the zombie sequel is that blonde chick was a pretty good extra character that they added. That was good. Unfortunately, she left the film at a certain point, too, which was unfortunate.
And I still enjoyed Zombieland 2. I did not enjoy it nearly as much as Zombieland 1, but it was certainly fine for an evening at the theater, at least for me. And so I just was checking, and while the director has talked about a sequel and a lot of people have speculated about a sequel, I guess it hasn't been officially greenlit yet, but it was definitely set up to have one. Yeah. And there were plans to do one if the money works out, I'm sure.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, I wonder what they would write, what story they would use, or would they just use different characters?
Smart, they'll just tell us a story. It's going to be Love and Monsters 2, boy, and then we're good.
Love and Monsters 2, boy. Oh, the dog. Gotcha.
The dog.
Just dog. Yeah. Nothing but dog. As he goes on the quest for the red dress.
Well, the one thing that's good about this movie here is even if they did do it a sequel, the universe is pretty cool. Everybody has to agree with that.
I thought so.
Oh, yeah. I love the world building. I thought it was really awesome.
Even if it is silly how it happened, Eric, with the chemicals and such.
Well, so is dropping a nuclear weapon that causes a dinosaur that's been dead for 65 million years to A, come to life, B, grow to monstrous size, and C, turn into a dragon.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's right. That's right. And why do people turn into wolves when the full moon is out?
It's a curse. Right. That's clearly explained.
That's a fair point, Eric. I'll
Here you go. So I'm just skimming over an interview with the director. Was there ever a version where the dog died? He said, no, there wasn't. So there was no.
Right. Yeah. Based off of how this movie goes, you could tell that it was light. It was supposed to be a light science fiction film and not dark and depressing. And
I think they should go with Mike's idea for the sequel and just call it Boy, because then people are going to be thinking it's like one of those puppet movies or whatever, and just go see a movie about a dog. That would be funny.
Boy 3, the dog. the Sand Snake, who plays his girlfriend, she's had two minor roles in two horror films this year, or in 2020, Love and Monsters and Underwater. She was the survivor in Underwater.
That's where I recognize the name from.
Yep. And she was one of the Sand Snakes. I forget which one.
I don't recognize her in normal clothes.
Right, right. Yeah, because this is the first time she's worn normal clothes, right? Because
right.
Yeah, Underwater, she's in like a suit, and then Sand Snake, she's in like medieval stuff.
Or whatever the hell you want to call that outfit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, anything else anyone want to bring up? Yeah? Are we done with the movie? All right.
Before we started.
The snail. My daughter was freaking about the snail too because because he's saying don't move, and my daughter's going, oh my god, and I go, no, the snail's our friend. He's like, friend, and I'm just lying my ass off. I have no idea at this point. and then Michael Rourke goes, oh yeah, that's a friendly snail. It's like, oh my god, I lucked out.
you lucked out through the entire movie, it seemed.
I did. Well. You know, it did say.
So we now know that Phil is willing to lie his ass off to prevent himself from getting in trouble with his wife.
Well, also to make my daughter not be all depressed and sad and crying and stuff too.
Oh, all right, if you say so.
Yeah, I do. All right, and now she watches the film religiously with popcorn, with no problems.
Religiously? She holds a cross while she's watching a movie?
Well, the popcorn's a cross.
I thought she kneels in front of the TV and whips herself.
Oh, I think that Sand Snake was the one with the whip. Yeah. Anyway, I guess that's pretty much about the film, unless it's kind of drying out, so... We can discuss about what we've been watching or news and stuff. So the first news I want to bring up was the weird situation and still probably a little weird because I think she still may have some medical conditions. But
she actually passed.
Tanya Roberts?
Yeah.
So it is official.
It was initially reported incorrectly, but now it has happened, is my understanding.
Okay, so... Wow, that's too bad. So Tanya Roberts, 65 years old. Well, it says here, 2 days ago, it says critical condition. Yeah, you're right. She did pass, it says, yeah. Okay. Wow, that's terrible. So anyway, she was out walking her dog and then just... had something happen and she died. So she was a James Bond girl. She was in Sheena. She was in a number of horror films such as Tourist Trap. She was pretty big in the 80s. And then, of course, she was on that 70s show. So she died young, 65, which is too bad. Let's see.
Welcome to 2021, where we kill your favorite celebrities twice.
Yeah, because it was reported she passed, but then it was reported that it was premature. And then you're right, Eric. Then it was announced that she did pass. So rest in peace to Tanya Roberts. Yeah, she was one of the big sex symbols of the 80s for young folks at that time. So rest in peace. Any other news anybody wanted to bring up?
Nope, nothing at all interesting happening in the world whatsoever.
At least that movie.
All right, so that's the case. What we've been watching, I've been playing Cyberpunk 2077 still. Really good, having no issues now. So the automatic updates that they've been pumping through the systems has fixed any problems that I guess other people were having, because I haven't had any problems. And yeah, it's really good. So if you like Cyberpunk stuff, obviously, it's pretty cool. But also it's like a Grand Theft Auto or Saints Row in a Cyberpunk world. And the world is huge. It's a pretty solid game. So I highly recommend there. I saw a film called Bird Kill. It's on Hulu. No, it's on Amazon Prime, I think. I think it's Amazon Prime, but it was free on Amazon Prime. And that was a really good thriller. Basically, a woman who likes bird watching goes out to the woods and finds a car breaks down. And then she goes to this guy's house, and the guy may be a terrorist that's living out in the woods. And she may not even be who she says either. So there's a lot of twists and turns. It's a really solid throw, I felt. And that's all I've seen recently. So I'll pass it over to you, Eric.
Oh, okay. I got a list. I watched a sci-fi movie called Volition, which it's a time travel deal, but it's done in a way that's different than I've seen before. So I appreciate it for that. I liked it. On Amazon Prime, I watched one of the new Blumhouse movies, Black Box. And I guess I'd also classify that as a sci-fi. I enjoyed that as well. On Shudder, I watched a movie called The Cleansing Hour, which is a possession movie that I really liked. So I would recommend that. I watched Freaky, which is way too expensive. I rented it when Dan and Susie were over, because that's the only way I could justify that stupid $19.99 rental bullshit. But other than that, the movie was enjoyable. Vince Vaughn was particularly good in Freaky, so I would recommend that.
How would you have enjoyed it if it was $7?
More.
I would concur with that, Eric. Yeah.
So I just want to be clear here. I was the one at the beginning of the year when this happened that said I don't really have a problem with them doing this. And you were probably the most vociferous critic of this.
Absolutely. I fucking hate it.
And yet you wanted to watch this movie
before I end the year show, because I'm dedicated to the show.
And you gave them your money, and I didn't. I'm just saying something seems out of whack here.
Yes, you are out of whack. Anyway, to continue, I watched a sci-fi movie called Archive, which was good and a little weird. And actually, like, at the end, they threw a curveball that I didn't see coming until right before it. So I appreciated it for that. So Archive, I'd recommend. Watch a movie called Spree. Basically about it's a rideshare driver. The service in the movie is called Spree because they didn't want to get sued by Lyft or Uber. that wants to go viral on social media, so he starts picking up people and killing them. So that was okay. I finally received my Arrow 4K edition of Tremors. and actually, Mike, you know what? I'm actually happy that you got yours first before me, since you ordered it 2 months prior to me, because to me that means the order of the universe is correct. You heard it first, you should get it first.
I do know Amazon, it doesn't always work that way,
doesn't it? All right.
But yeah, it looks fantastic, and there's some fun special features. If you like Tremors and are willing to spend the money on a collector's edition, I would recommend this one. On Shudder, I watched a Korean horror movie called The Closet. It's kind of a supernatural, I guess you call it a ghost movie. And I really enjoyed that. Recommend it.
Is this like in the same genre as Deathbed and The Elevator?
I don't know if I've seen those movies.
Oh, Innocuous Household Objects that murder people.
Yes, I heard of those. And there was one called The Refrigerator, too.
Oh, Deathbed, the bed that eats? No.
Yes.
I've seen that movie.
Did you think I was referring to a different Deathbed movie?
There could be another movie. You got to use the full title. You got to use the full title. The title of the movie is Deathbed, the bed that eats.
Yeah, I forget. There's Asylum. They would totally do a knockoff of Deathbed.
There's also a movie called The Killer Bong as well.
But no, it is not like that. So The Closet, I would say, is much better than any of those movies.
It's a shame because The Closet at least kind of sort of has a mouth opening it could use, right? You know, to consume.
Then on Netflix, I watched a movie called His House. Because
I heard that one. Yeah.
I heard a bunch of buzz about it, and I wanted to check it out before we do our list next week. I'm not as high on it as a lot of people seem to be. I mean, it's definitely a well-made movie, but it didn't really do it for me. So I give His House a meh. Then I watched also on Netflix a sci-fi movie called The Midnight Sky, starring and directed by George Clooney, which was okay. It was relatively slow-paced. I think they could have shaved about 30 minutes off that movie to pick it up a little bit, but it's an okay sci-fi movie. I'm not going to push people to watch it. If you're bored and you have Netflix, check it out. And that's what I've seen.
All right, very good. Mike?
I've watched a few. I'm trying to remember what I've watched since we last did it. I think one I watched is on Shudder, Blood Vessel.
You already mentioned this one to us.
Mentioned Blood Quantum.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
All right. So I totally understand the confusion because for a little while I was getting them confused myself. But Blood Vessel is a World War II film in which a bunch of people from a sunken Allied ship.
So vessel like boat, vessel, not like aneurysm blood vessel.
Right.
Well, yeah. Oh, kinda, but kind of because they end up on. End up on a boat that's just sunk by the Nazis, and on their lifeboat eventually comes across a Nazi ghost ship. And when they get onto the Nazi ghost ship, it turns out the Nazis have been engaging in occult activities and have a couple of vampires in the hold. So you got some Nazi vampires. So if you want a Nazi vampire movie.
I wonder if that's original or not, that the Nazis matter. Are occultists. Hmm. But either way, Shudder has – I get that friggin' ad every day on Facebook. That they always – that's their ad that pops up in my feed, the trailer for that film.
So that was one film.
Mike, was it good?
Oh, yeah. It was okay.
Okay.
It is – You know what? I'm trying to remember if I put it on my – did I remember to put it on my list of films? I'm trying to think. I added so many films the other day. I don't remember if I actually included it. I don't think I did. I missed one. I got to add it in. And I don't know that I added Blood Quantum in either. All right. So my list is going to grow. Another one I watched was I can't remember the correct name. Vampires versus the Bronx?
Oh, yeah.
I heard of that one, yeah.
Which is on Netflix, and it's fun. It's not great, but it's fun. It's competent.
With Eddie Murphy's movie, Vampire in the Bronx.
Yeah, it's not Vampires in the Bronx. It's Vampires versus the Bronx. And I enjoyed it. Not going to light the world on fire, but if you're looking for another good... So now I'm happy because I have two vampire movies this year. So I have a choice for best vampire movie of the year. Is it going to be Blood Vessel? Or is it going to, which is now that you know that there's vampires on a boat, it's a double play on
Got
words.
It. All
right. Right. Or Vampires on the in the Versus the Bronx, which is a literal title that has no wordplay whatsoever in it. I also watched the sequel to Babysitter, The Babysitter Killer Queen. And I really enjoyed it until the end, where I did not like how it ended. And the babysitter from the first film, Samara Weaving, because she's gone on to be... I don't want to say that's the reason why. I'm assuming the reason why is probably because she's become a bigger star and her price is probably outside of the Netflix budget for the moment, or what they were willing to pay for Babysitter Killer Queen. She only appears in like the last 5 to 10 minutes of the film. And I really don't like how they handled her character in those last 5 to 10 minutes. Up till then, I had a blast with the movie. I thought the movie was a lot of fun. There is a character twist with one of the characters from the returning from the original film. It is on Netflix. I would recommend giving it a watch. Not brilliant, but okay. Let's see. What else would I had seen? We've obviously have done Love and Monsters. The Wolf of Snow Hollow. I saw that. I enjoyed that.
I got a question for you, Mike. Do you think that belongs on the horror list?
Because of the nature of the subject, kinda.
What's the name of the film?
The Wolf of Snow Hollow, where it's a story about people who are getting brutally murdered on the night.
I'm familiar with it. If you want to tell the audience that's listening, sorry, go ahead.
Right, so that's what it is, right? So, and it has the name, the word wolf in the title. And I don't want to go too far because you might be spoiling things. If I go any further than that.
I also enjoyed that movie. I couldn't figure out whether it belongs on the horror list or not, though. I've got it there for right now.
Yeah, so do I, and I've seen that on a lot of best of horror films lists. So since everybody else is doing it, I will succumb to peer pressure and put it there.
Cool. We can smoke some weed in the parking lot later.
Yeah, there we go. I'm actually though I'm more in the age group where we're more like doing Bengay in the bathroom.
That sounds no. Move on.
But anyway, The Wolf of Snow Hollow I really liked. I think it was a good film. A lot of fun dialogue, but the intense moments also work really well. And that's probably on my top 10 list of the year, along with these other two films. And one Eric has already spoken about, which was The Cleansing Hour, which is one of the better possession films I think I've seen in a long time. And I'm not really sure why. Because it's more or less a one room exorcism scene throughout the entire film. There are some cutaways, but it's basically a one room story for 90% of the film. I do like it. I kind of like the ending. Does not go where I was expecting it to go.
Right.
And the idea that they basically do fill a compelling 90 minutes with really just doing an exorcism, I think worked really well. And I do like the actress who plays the possessed demon, because this is a demon with some, with some attitude and just very, with a lot of snark. And I kind of enjoyed her. That is a big kind of surprise for me. And then one that really went up very much on the top of my list, I don't know where it's going to settle, is a movie called Scare Me, which is on Shudder.
Somebody else talked about this on a podcast earlier today.
Right. So it's a very simple idea, and you could argue whether or not this is a horror film too. It certainly is horror adjacent. It is basically about two people who are writers holed up in a cabin in the woods, who are bouncing stories off each other. So they were just telling each other scary stories, and that's it for the most part. And it's a lot of fun and creative, and they never do like a cutaway to show you the stories they're telling. So it is like you are watching these two people tell their stories and act out their stories. And it's so much is done just with creative direction and lighting and sound effects, because let's say the character says, you know, and then the sheriff opens a beer and, you know, he'll pantomime the sheriff opening the beer and cracking open the beer, and they'll play the sound effect of the beer opening where we, even though you don't actually see it happen. So they get a lot of the flavor of the story through use of sound effects, which I think was a really neat use of sound in the film.
That's different.
And I thought that was ended up being a really good 90-minute movie. And just one of the most creative films as a result of that, storytelling films that I've seen this year. So that one really rocketed up to the top of my list too. So yeah, I highly recommend that one.
All right, very good.
And I think that's
about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Abe, you got video games, movies, anything, TV?
Nothing new on my end, honestly. Been busy with work and stuff, you know, writing. So nothing so far, really. Nothing new, at least.
All right, very good. All right, sounds good. So before we give our final thoughts, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan and a couple others too?
Yeah, I do. The one I do with my buddy Dan is a general interest podcast called The Askancity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find that wherever you got this one. The other one I've started doing is a weekly movie commentary podcast called The Bateman Movie Cast. And every week we turn on a movie and just shoot the shit. And most of the time we're talking about the movie. Sometimes we're not. And we just kind of do a commentary like you hear on a disc. So if that interests you at all, you can find that at I can't even speak. You can find that at geeknerdery.com.
All right, very good. All right, Mike, me, you, and Eric usually do another podcast that we're hoping to start up near the end of this month.
Yeah, so it would be the Cinema a la Carte podcast, where you and Eric and I, as you just mentioned, typically review a film that is not normally Dark Discussions material. So, for example, we've reviewed a Pixar film, Inside Out. We've reviewed an Edgar Wright film, Baby Driver. We reviewed a little art housey film with a little dog called Stolet, which for some reason has an R in the title. I don't know why. And we've got others coming along the way. So we each pick a film and we do this once a month and we rotate. And it's basically something we want to talk about that we would not really be able to squeeze into Dark Discussions.
All right. Sounds good. Yeah, for myself, doing a podcast with Barrett on The Stand called Don't Tell Me, I'll Tell You, The Stand podcast. It's basically a weekly episode on the brand new 2020 CBS All Access 9-episode miniseries of Stephen King's The Stand, or based off of Stephen King's The Stand. Also doing a podcast with Barrett and Kevin on the second season of the television show A Discovery of Witches, and that starts up this week, and that's called Discovery of Witches, Demons, and Vampires podcast. So folks can check out the first episode of that that came out as a recap of season one. And that's pretty much all I got. All right, so I guess we can give our final thoughts on this film here. So, hey, what do you got?
So I really enjoyed this film a lot. I think for 2020, I think this might be my favorite film. I had a lot of fun with the awesome creatures. I enjoyed the humor, the heart. It was just a great adventure. Honestly, if you ever come out with that kind of sketch, the character's sketchbook of all the creatures and stuff like that, I would definitely buy a heartbeat. I would even get the DVD as well. I just really enjoyed this film. You know, I'd be happy if it was a standalone or had a sequel either way. But overall, I'm just happy. I just thought this was a great experience. If you're looking for a movie with a lighthearted adventure and some really cool creatures, this is definitely a recommend. So yeah, I'm really happy we finally got to go see this, and those are my thoughts.
All right. And for Mike, what do you got?
Wrap up the thoughts. I like the movie a lot. I highly recommend it. If you like giant monster movies, you get a lot of giant monsters in it. And they actually are pertinent to the story. And there's actually, unlike most giant monster movies, I think there's a decent human story here, too.
All right. Very good. Myself. Yeah, I thought this was a fantastic film. I think I'll put it on one of my top 10 lists of the year. It's really good. Very enjoyable. And as Mike said, it has giant monsters. So good stuff. Eric.
I didn't like this movie as much as anybody else, but I think it has cool creature effects, and I'm glad other people are enjoying it.
All right. Sounds good. So once again, this is the movie Love and Monsters from 2020, starring Dylan O'Brien and Jessica Henwick and Michael Rooker, among other folk, including Ellen Holman and a number of other smaller roles by people of note. It's available for a VOD rental at this time, so you or you purchase, but it's not free on any services yet. But it's definitely highly recommended by at least three of us. And if you folks want to give your thoughts, email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com or go to darkdiscussions.com and press the contact us, and we will read your email on the podcast episodes. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening. Let's talk about Love and Monsters. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.
Think I'm coming down. You know I think I'm coming down. Yes, I think I'm coming down. You know I think I'm coming down. Took everything I had, took my good and made me bad. Then you taught me how to fly, but you let me fly too high. Now I think I'm coming down. Yes, I think I'm coming down. You know I think I'm coming down. Yes, I think I'm coming down. Lie on, lovebird, go free. Don't look back at me. You've stolen all the best. Now no one wants the rest. And I think I'm coming down. You know I think I'm coming down. Yes, I think I'm coming down.